One of the things that happen when we give a higher dose of GnRH, they ovulate a little bit sooner in the beginning of the protocol, and consequently, they come in natural a little bit earlier.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Dairy Science Digest. This is a podcast designed to bring the Journal of Dairy Science straight to the ears of dairy producers. I'm Reagan Blewell with the University of Missouri Dairy Team, and today we're meeting with Dr. Fabio Lima from UC Davis. Not many listeners have forgotten about the January announcement from USDA talking about how our heifer inventories of females greater than 500 pounds are at a 20-year low. Breeding efficiency in this very fertile class of production, it's always been important. However, now under this inventory crunch, it feels increasingly important to get the future of our herd bred, and bred in a timely fashion. Some interesting numbers that came out of the University of Wisconsin Extension survey data looked at production costs from 1999 to 2015 has increased from $1,300 to $2,500 per head. And so as we illuminate the cost associated on the number of days on feed for these heifers, we quickly see that reproductive efficiency really matters to the bottom line of our operation. Today, we invited Dr. Lima to discuss the tweaks of this short breeding protocol that might look similar to some of us. Maybe we've seen it in a little bit in the past, but there's slight modifications that could impact pregnancy success potentially. And so the title of this month's featured article from the Journal of Dairy Science is "The Effect of 200 Micrograms of Gonadarellin Hydrochloride at the First GnRH of a Cedar Sink Program on Ovulation Rate and Pregnancy per AI in Holstein Heifers." So, Fabio, thank you for coming to the Dairy Science Digest. But before we really get diving into the data, could you tell the audience a little bit about yourself?
First of all, thanks for the invitation, Reagan. It's a pleasure to contribute to the podcast and share some of the work with our dairy community so they can have more tools to make their decisions. I'm originally from Brazil. I moved to the U.S. in 2004. My first experience was at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I did the last year of veterinary training, working with Dr. Milo Otbank, doing research there. And then I moved to University of California, Davis, work as a research assistant with Dr. Jose Santos. And then I moved to University of Florida, did my residence, trained, master, PhD. I was at Cornell, the postdoc, and then for almost 5 years as a professor at University of Illinois. And then finally, I moved here to UC Davis, where I'm an assistant, now associate professor of livestock health and reproduction. So my research program mostly, it works in the intersection of health reproduction, mostly in dairy cows. And I'm also trying to work with strategies that can have direct impact on the dairy farmer routine, and reproductive performance, it's one of those that it's particularly important. Mm-hmm. And I had a particular interest on dairy heifers because it's part of what I worked since my PhD and kept trying to work and tweaking and helping refine what we have available.
Fantastic. Yeah, what a robust dossier that you have there from all of the big hitters for reproduction and specifically the dairy industry. And we know that these synchronization protocols, they've been around for decades at this point, and we've got proven results. But your team employed a little over 1,300 of these breeding age heifers. They averaged about 15 months of age to study some subtle protocol changes. So let's talk a little bit through what was the overarching protocol, and then explore the modification of the GnRH, please.
Yeah, so the overarching protocol, it's a very similar protocol to actually what we worked to refine when I was doing my PhD at University of Florida 10 years ago, over 10 years ago, actually. And basically, it's a combination of starting a program, which we call a Cedar Sink. The original program, the one that's widely recommended and used, it's you start with GnRH, you put a cedar together. The GnRH is to induce ovulation, get their follicular rate going. Then you put a cedar to avoid them to come and nest within the middle of the program. And then you go 5 days later, you remove the seed and you give prostaglandin to lyse the corpus luteum, give a second prostaglandin to optimize luteolus, and then you do GnRH plus timed AI. day 8.
This is a nice consolidated program where after 9 days, she's got semen in her track and you're on your way to achieving fewer days on feed for that non-lactating animal.
This program was slightly different simply because the partner that we found for that study. So instead of doing the 5 days for the feed, we did the 6 days. That was, you know, the routine in the farm. That's how it works. So their employees don't work over the week. They raise heifers for three large dairy producers in California, and they were doing that successfully.
Love it. Very good. And let's kind of zoom out a little bit and talk more in terms of what dairymen are drawing out into the syringe. So the 100 versus the 200 is really just talking about 2 cc's versus 4 cc's of GnRH. And in this particular study, you guys utilize Factrel, right?
That's correct. That's correct.
Okay. Yeah. What are some other GnRH resources out there that are on the shelf available to dairymen?
There is quite a few different products over there. There is Ovacyst, there is Cystorelin, there is Fertigil. Mm-hmm. There is quite a few different other options. There is Gonabred. So most of them actually are different salts. This is what we call gonadine hydrochloride. And the other one is like the gonadine diacetate. There are different salts, but there is comparison between the two, and a lot of the responses, even though they're slightly different, for the most part, they are not remarkably different. I would anticipate that, you know, whatever benefits you see with one, you would likely see with the others, different breeds.
So when you were designing this program and really trying to look at the difference between 2 cc's or 4 cc's of GnRH, what is the function of GnRH? I mean, we just automatically deliver this injection because the sheet of paper tells us to, but what is that doing to the heifer when you inject GnRH?
Sure. So what GnRH is doing, it's going to the pituitary gland and leading to the release of two major hormones that will act in the ovary. One, it's LH, so you have what is responsible to induce ovulation with luteinization, and also you have release of FSH, follicle stimulating hormone. What we generally say, we'll get a new wave of follicles growing. So you get those two different events. So what that does, it resets the follicular waves. You are more likely when you go inseminate that animal that you have a follicle that has a non-age. It's not 2 age or immature, not fully mature, but it's in the ideal time point to respond in the end of the protocol when you're inseminating a cow. So you're trying to optimize the time of the recruitment of the follicle and the time that you induce ovulation. So that's the general idea. And the factors that we know that influence the success is if they ovulate, they are more likely to be well synchronized and they are more likely to become pregnant at the end of the protocol. That is the same thing for heifers and for cows. We want that the beginning of the synchronization have that ovulation, okay? Because that is being associated with pregnancy outcomes, has been a hallmark of improved pregnancy outcomes.
You bet. In your group, you had a subgroup of about 30% of the animals that underwent ultrasound and blood draw to confirm that ovulation. Let's just dive right into those results a little bit and talk about what did you see in those analyses?
Sure. So what we learned that as expected, when we gave 4 cc instead of 2 cc's of GnRH, we thought that it went up the ovulation. It went from 42.7 to 54.7%. And as we expected, the animals that we characterized as high and low for progesterone, we saw that the animals that had the high progesterone ovulate less, 37%, and compared to animals that had low progesterone, high, obviously, as we expected, did have a negative impact on ovulation response. So you went up from 37 to 6. But what was surprising to us is that even though those two responses were aligned to what we expected, when we look at the interaction of treatment by progesterone, there was not an interaction. You know, there was perhaps, let's say, a large magnitude of increase in the animals that were high. But when we look at the animals that were low, even though there was also an increase. So they were trending the same way. That's a way to say that there is no interaction.
Yeah, it kind of diluted the effect. I sure was excited as I was reading through the article. I was like, oh, they got more ovulation, significantly more ovulation, but it didn't necessarily translate into an effect that we were really seeking. So we often think that the increased ovulation is going to translate to increased pregnancy effect, but in this particular situation, it did not, did it?
It did not. Unfortunately, even though the initial trigger that we thought that could lead to improved pregnancy outcomes, it did not translate into any improved pregnancy outcome. We did not see difference in pregnancy outcomes. They were not significant. They were similar, 30.60 for the two and 58.8 for the four. But there was no significance, so it is not different, basically. That was surprising. We do have a few thoughts about it, but it was not what we were expecting for sure.
I do think, let's rewind just a little bit though, the fact that your pregnancy at day 37 when you did the ultrasound, I mean, it on average was about 59%. And I think noteworthy is that all 1300 heifers were bred utilizing sexed semen. I also noticed that some of them were sexed beef. In your conversations with these collaborating research herds, could you speak a little bit about their mating strategies? And I know that's not maybe necessarily part of this research project, but it was interesting to see that they might be using sexed beef semen on heifers.
Goes down to these heifers. They are all, genotypes, and they have the ones that they want to use to generate the next pool of replacements. So once they achieve a potential replacement for the herd, then they will start using the beef. The fact that they have such a high pregnancy outcomes and they have enough replacements by doing that's a popular way that their farms have identified to have an extra source of income. But
Sure.
that's also aligned to the problem that you alluded to in the beginning, that also we're having replacement availability, let's say
Yeah.
it's the lowest it has been, but there's a risk. Like everything else, when you push the panel too much one side, you got to be careful because it will put you in trouble on the other side. So that's something that, with their farmers, they need to just plan well so they have enough
Sure.
replacements. Otherwise, they're going to be paying very expensively to buy from others to keep their herds, their full capacity.
It's absolutely a balancing act, but I think, as if I could applaud the listenership of this particular podcast, I think it does show to the professionalism of dairy producers going forward. I mean, guys understand what their bottom line is. They understand what those numbers are for days on feed for their heifers, and they recognize the fact that for the last 4 years, from April 2018 to January of 22, Cobank reported that the average dairy heifer never exceeded $1,400. And so, if they're not getting the return on the cost associated with feeding and rearing these heifers for 2 years of commitment, it just makes sense. And I think this is a topic that many dairymen are becoming increasingly aware of and are really striving to go that direction. But you bring up a really important point to have a sharp pencil and know exactly what your cull rate is and calculate what your needs are going forward, because 24 months is a long time, and that lag can bite you if you're not prepared to replace that aging animal that needs to be culled. So yeah, sorry, I just picked that up in the paper, and I know it's not directly affiliated, but it's very relevant currently. So let's circle back a little bit to talk about the impact. So you've got the luteinizing hormone and progesterone. Talk about that relationship a little bit. As I was reading through your discussion, I was not familiar with the fact that there's a relationship between those two hormones. Could you expand upon that?
Sure. So what takes place is that when progesterone, it's, let's say, we call high. So in general, as ovulation goes up, it will impact two things. It will impact the number and the amplitude of the number of peaks that you get released and how high those peaks go. So there's some studies that were done in the past. There's some studies from myself and from Julio Jordan where we saw that if they have high progesterone, their LH release, it's maybe less than half than the ones that we are doesn't have as high, depending upon how you characterize, if you look at the groups. So it's one of the things, and some of the heifers, they're very good body condition score. They have been cycling a while. They might have had more than one cycle. They might have pretty high concentration of progesterone. And some of those animals, the single dose might not be sufficient to have enough LH release to successfully induce ovulation. You know, the magnitude and the number of pulses that might be induced by the exogenous single dose of GnRH might not be sufficient. So that's why we've been doing some studies trying to see if a higher dose optimizes the response that we have in the beginning of the program and subsequently the response that we have in the protocol generally.
What causes the effect of elevated or high or low progesterone? Is that a genetic related condition?
That could be a factor. Like, for example, we have twinning and genetically inherited. So you can see that multiple ovulation, there's the trio gene that's associated with more ovulations in their health, and that is a factor. But it's not the only factor. There have been other associations with subsequent protocol. Like, we speculate that could happen because we have seen that in their health, particularly in animals that have what we call high progesterone. So that's an issue we explore in their cows because of like when we do the double of zinc, it's more commonly to have cows that have more corpus luteum because we did entire of zinc before starting of zinc, and they have high progesterone because of that. Very high progesterone can have a negative impact on LH release and ovulation consequence of that. So when I was working my PhD at the University of Florida at the time, we did see the similar problem that the ovulation rate in heifers, it's particularly low. The impact that is the high progesterone. So they're like, well, perhaps they could also benefit from an increased dose.
Let's do a little history dive. Where did the 2 cc's of GnRH come from?
If you look historically, what led to use 200 micrograms, it's not that you don't have improved ovulation if you increase the dose, but it's the law of diminished return. You know, like it's like, yeah, you have a little bit more ovulation, but does that pay off? At the time when people were trying to characterize what was the best overall response dose, the 100 micrograms became the gold standard for the synchronization programs. But those programs were that were developed, they were initially not yet like a double up sync, were not yet, you know, like synchronization, were different scenarios. There were a lot of patients on, and you know, the cost of the hormones 20 some years ago and everything was different. So that's why we've been bringing back that, like, well, maybe there is opportunities to reassess the tools and see if that translates into benefits when we try to align the biological principles. If you do a double of zinc, you're giving GnRH in the what we call the pre-sync of zinc twice. So you're inducing follicles to ovulate. As consequently, you have more source to produce that progesterone, and subsequently that will lead to have higher. In heifers, I would say it's probably more genetic. It's probably more that than anything. And there's variability across the population. So you would try to put them all in the same bucket, but they are heterogeneous. You're gonna see that variability on the ability. Perhaps, you know, like more intense metabolism, you know, for whatever reason, they might clear that progesterone from the blood more quickly and not achieve as high level of those and compared to the others. That might be related to their metabolization. So it's multifactorial, but genetics certainly can be listed as one of the factors that can contribute to that.
Now you touched on it, and it's a question that I get often whenever I teach my AI school where we're talking about different synchronization protocols, and I always get from the crowd a question about increased prevalence of twinning. And while I see that the p value was not significant, it does look like there might have been a trend when you increased your GnRH. Can you talk a little bit about the possibility of multiple ovulations as a result of the treatment?
So that is, it's part of what we need to keep in mind. So yes, as you induce ovulation, that is a factor that depending upon the scenarios, you will have issues with animals in the end that might have a higher odds of having twins. But the issue, you know, it has been well characterized. This kind of study from Richard Pursley and JP Martin, but it did a really elegant study where they shown that, you know, the animals that are really, really contributing for that double ovulation, the animals that are actually low in progest in the beginning of the protocols. We don't have as many twins in heifers as we do in older cows. You know, so there's a relationship with productivity and the fact that if the animals are, let's say, low progestin in the beginning of the protocol, if you're doing an off-seek without making sure that they have high progestin, and those animals, they are the ones that we're going to have, like, let's say, a protocol-related association with increased ovulatory response. So if you actually have high progestin in the beginning of the protocol, that follicle grows in an environment of high progestin, it seems like that their ability to have a single follicle that ovulates in the end, it's tempered by that. So, you want protocol that helps you have the beginning of the protocol high progestin. But you cannot, let's say, completely isolate that effect. So you will have, if you induce more ovulation in the beginning or in the end, you might have a higher odds of having that. And nowadays, it's true, meaning that we have seen an increase in twins and we cannot say that there's nothing related to the protocols, like protocols that perhaps are starting animals with low progestin, they contribute more, but it's not the only contributor.
Wonderful. If you could share that elegant study, I'd love to put a link to it in the show notes down below. So my absolute favorite question that I ask every researcher that comes online is, you know, if you were to summarize one particular thing that you really want boots on the ground dairy producers out there living the dream every day to know about your research project, what would be that one thing that you'd send them home with?
In this one particular is that even though you increase ovulation for this particular protocol, it's not sufficient to increase pregnancy. So you cannot recommend increasing the dose based on what we learned from this study in this particular protocol. But I must acknowledge that I have had other researchers that did different studies. Like that, for example, there is a study from Marcus Collazo at the University of Alberta in Canada, where they did the 5 days, the smaller scale study, but they did the difference in pregnancy. And one thing that was in different in that particular study, it was that they did a 5 day, like the typical protocol, not the alteration. And when we're trying to understand what is taking place was that on our study, we had one extra day that the follicle was growing under high progesterone before we induced to have that corpogluteinized lyse and come in estrus. And what we learned is that one of the things that happen when we give a higher dose of GnRH, they ovulate a little bit sooner in the beginning of the protocol, and consequently, they come in natural a little bit earlier. And in this farm, they were not breeding like a day before, for example, to take advantage of that. They were very strict. I mean, they breed in the day of they breed. You might have some animals that got 4 cc's that actually they come in natural a little bit earlier. So then when you go breed them, even though they were well synchronized in the beginning, they might have had a follicle that's too old.
Too far gone, right.
Some heifers were coming estrus day 8 in our study.
Yeah.
And they were not breathing on day 8. Then, like the benefit of the initial ovulation, they got offset because you didn't breed those animals early. That's probably what would explain the difference.
It makes me wonder, though, you know, what if you would have cherry picked? You know, and I know we can't, we certainly can't really ascertain any of that from this particular data set. And the important part of research is that you can't cherry pick because you're trying to capture this data. But who knows what would have happened had we grabbed those animals. Yeah.
Absolutely. I think, you know, like, it, you know, I wish it was part of what we could have done for that particular study, because then we would have that information to share. But if I were to speculate, because that's sometimes that's what we have to do when we cannot actually, I would speculate that there is a high likelihood that we would increase animals that were bred in the optimal time and potentially pregnant. Yeah. But so that's what I'm saying, you know, like the responses are specific to the scenario. For 6 days, it didn't seem to work. For a 5 day, I must provide you also the data from Colazo people can look at. In that particular study, they did see a difference. Their pregnancy increased from 63 to 75.9. It's slightly different scenarios, but I would say there is not one fit all scenarios. That's why we do certain studies to try to understand. But 6 days, not worthwhile doing extra dose. 5 days, I would say look at that study and use that to guide you.
And again, I'll put a clickable link to that particular study too, because that was just, let me see, that was just short of 10 percentage points increase of pregnancy opportunity there with the 5 day. I think it's an important detail, guys, to realize that we feature all types of journal articles, right? And it's important to recognize, as a scientist, I trust that you and your team poured your heart, soul, and dreams into this. And sometimes it's frustrating to analyze the data and realize, it didn't work better. But that information is so important for dairy producers to realize, because now we know that perhaps the combination of a 6 day seeder in addition to the 4 cc's of GnRH is not a win. Because if that GnRH is truly, in fact, causing the ovulation to occur quicker, let me see, in the data that you referenced, it says 61 hours versus 54 hours. That matters, because if you don't have semen sitting in the track waiting for that egg that just got ovulated, you miss the mark. And we all know that. But this is great information to know and to recognize that so often we have dairy producers that want to just slightly tweak these protocols to maybe fit their herd a little bit better. But recognizing that just a few hours makes a huge difference on the impact of your fertility. So take a moment to make sure that you're being compliant with the protocols that you know are going to be working because of research, and it's a research-backed protocol. Well, Dr. Lima, this has been very informative. I want to thank you for your time. And listeners, I applaud you for taking time out of your day today to learn about this heifer synchronization protocol. I've really enjoyed our conversation. This has been the March edition of Dairy Science Digest, a monthly podcast project designed to bring the Journal of Dairy Science straight to your ears. We highlight peer-reviewed research articles actively in press. It's sound science that you can base your management decisions around, provided to you by your University of Missouri dairy team. So please be sure to like, share, and subscribe to get future editions straight to your cell phone. This is Reagan Bluell with the Dairy Science Digest, and I hope you have a great day.